Hello and welcome back to W Rated, the podcast where we willingly watch the world's worst rated movies. Today is a very special episode for two reasons. First of all, I'm not recording this alone in a room. I'm recording it with someone else in the room, and it just so happens to be co-creator, editor, and host of the podcast, Claire.
I feel like it would have been far more exciting if it was someone else.
Stop.
I was like, who's in the room? Oh, I got you.
And are these people in the room right now? She's like looking around going, who is the poltergeist or spectre that is joining us today? No, I'm very excited to have you in the room here with me, as I always am when I get to see you. And I'm particularly excited that we get to talk about what we're going to be talking about today. So as I said, this is a special episode. We are not going to be talking about another film on IMDb's bottom 100 list today. We are in celebration of finishing our Uwe Bonanza. Mm-hmm. Is that how we're naming it? I might have mispronounced it, but I'm still trying to make sure I pronounce Uwe Boll's name right. Just in celebration of the films we've watched so far this year. We did Blood Rain last year, but our recent releases will have been Alone in the Dark, Dungeon Siege Tale. In the Name of the King, a Dungeon Siege Tale. Yeah. There we go. And Far Cry. So, Claire, I'm going to pass it to you today as we don't have a guest. Do you want to tell us more about what we're watching in celebration of the end of the season? This mini season that we've made up.
Our mini summer.
And why we've decided to watch it today.
Yeah, so we are going to be talking about a documentary called Raging Bull. It's a documentary that follows Uwe Boll. He did not direct it. About, you know, his journey as a filmmaker, and what led to the infamous challenge of him asking multiple film critics to step up and have a boxing match with him, because he was fed up of them writing personal attacks in their reviews of his film.
Yeah.
And he said, if it's personal, let's make it personal.
Yeah. And I think that's like the sort of reputation that's preceded him throughout this hard time we've been talking about him. We've spoken quite at length with each episode about how we didn't really know him before, you know, we had some sort of expectations about his films going in, and then we watched them, they're kind of really not what we expected, and maybe a lot of the sort of repulsion from people is like, how awful this man is. So, and related to the fact that he challenged people in the boxing ring, we're like, oh God, what kind of egomaniac are we dealing with here? Like, we were like, we were always joking about, should we review these films? Are we safe? So that's why it was really interesting to watch this documentary and learn more about the guy himself and what led specifically to those events. So Raging Bull.
Yes. So it was directed, produced and written by Dan Lee West. And it was also co-written and edited by Thomas Sabansky. And quite a lot of kind of older archive footage than I expected. A lot of stuff about him. Most of the archive footage followed him on a trip home to Germany and then trying to get In the Name of the King distributed.
Yes.
Which I guess that was his fourth film, so it was around the time when internet trolls, I guess? Internet reviewers started to troll.
Because I mentioned when we were watching it about when was this out, because it does feel like the shots feel very naughty. Like it looks like it's been filmed on, you know, the old Sony kind of tape camera, kind of, or the mini disc camera, you know, it has that look to it. And we kind of worked our way back from the fact that this was released in 2010, I think we said, Claire. But the fact that it's a lot of archival footage, like the fact that he's trying to get In the Name of the King distributed, and that came out in 2007. So it's got to be at least like 2005, 2006. We were also mentioning, which will sort of make our point a bit more clear as we talk about it, but this is the age of like message boards, forums, you know, Perez Hilton, TMZ, like that kind of the internet. And he says it in the doc, like the internet is a wonderful thing. It means people are well connected. It means people get to create stuff. But it just, you know, it also harbors all of these people who feel like they can go out and say things about people.
Yeah, and they
have
can
an opinion on everything.
Heard.
Yeah, and they have a soapbox to stand on and get heard. And this documentary kind of highlights the sad. Well, I got sad. The sad and kind of like annoying and just disappointing side of that. So yeah, like I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, so I will caveat it. I think people should go and watch the documentary because I found it really interesting. Even if you don't know much about the films he made or the man himself. But it is kind of like a very all access documentary in that like Uwe Boll was very obviously pro. I don't know at what point they started filming the documentary, but he was clearly working with the filmmakers.
It was his story to tell. Yes. He wanted to get that across.
So I don't know how much bias there is throughout it, but it was fascinating. And I think Daisy is a stan now.
I'm sorry, guys. It's true. I think I've probably people will guess or worked it out. Like I'm an empath to my own undoing. But the amount of shots they had of this guy with plinky plonky music, with tears in his eyes. But it's the context. It's not just the manipulation of my emotions. It was, like you say, Claire, it's like, this is his story. This is an unbiased, we're going to show every side of what happened here. This was him getting his view of the situation of what happened across. And actually, in a way, it kind of levels out both sides because we're only really seeing and hearing the people who are saying all of this stuff. We've not really heard from the man himself apart from the threats, the boxing, right?
Well, and I think this is the thing that, like, I've kept saying after every, of all the films we've covered, I keep being like, his reputation preceded him. I think, you know, we've said it multiple times now when we started doing the podcast, everyone's like, oh my God, the Uwe Boll films, he's horrible, he's disgusting, his films are depraved, da 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 da. He started getting criticised after just two films. After two films, people were calling, like, which were Alone in the Dark and House of the Dead?
Yes.
Yeah. One of which we've seen, one of which we haven't.
Yeah.
And people were calling for him to, like, be banned from making movies and he shouldn't be allowed to do them anymore. And I think then his third film was Blood Rain. And when he started to do Blood Rain, people were, like, petitioning to have him banned from making movies. And then, you know, the documentary kind of goes to great lengths to show you some of these videos and some of the reviews. I think the thing that, like, when we've been watching these films, we've been like, ah, they're just not that good. But, like, I've seen tons of just as bad films and nothing about them is disgusting. We've not watched any of his originals.
It doesn't give you, like, a...
Disgusting, it doesn't, angry...
Yeah, it doesn't evoke negative emotions. The worst thing he did was bore me.
Yeah.
If anything.
And so that is sort of what the documentary seeks to kind of talk about, in the fact that, like, he's just making movies. He just has a love of movies and wants to make movies and make some money, which, you know, fair fucks, me too, mate.
Yeah.
And all of the reviews, or the ones that he's angry about, are all about he's the worst. Like, one of them was, like, the worst thing to happen to Germany since Hitler. Like,
yeah, it's just... And he was getting death threats as well, which, you know, it's just never... It's just not excusable, like
I
ever.
Love films. Let's maybe just not send people death threats in the films. You know, Peter Jackson ruined his adaptation of The Lovely Bones, but he deserves to continue living.
And he actually mentions in the doc about... He was very self-aware and he was very kind of rational in how he understood why people were doing that. Doesn't mean he didn't feel emotional. And as we got towards the end of the doc and beyond the boxing ring, the stuff he was kind of saying about some other directors and, you know, it wasn't... nice.
No.
But before that, he was kind of saying, you know, these people, they aren't, you know, it's unexcusable what they're doing. Mm-hmm. They're not critiquing my films. They're not even critiquing me.
Yeah.
They are personally attacking me and sending me death threats. And there's no film that can be that bad unless it, not even unless, but even if people are actually offending people, you can't do death threats. It's just not ever excusable. And it's just so strange having watched these films. And you're like, wow, like, what are you...
Yeah, like, of all the films I've ever seen, I wouldn't imagine that these are the ones that ended up with people having death threats and people in boxing rings.
Like, Human Centipede, you're like, not okay, but you're like, it adds up that he's getting death threats. Like, I'm not saying it's okay, but I know what human people are like.
Well, the one, like, this kind of, my brain's gone off on a tangent, as it loves to do, but, like, I saw someone on Twitter quite recently asking, like, are there any films that they think provoke pure evil?
Yeah, I saw that. And
one of them was, is it called Spurlo, so The Vanishing?
Vanishing? Oh, I haven't heard of that.
I got to see it last year, the IFI screened it for free, and off I went to go and watch it.
Yeah.
And it is an excellent movie, but it's about the abduction of a young woman, and right. you only find out in the very last shot what happened to her.
Right.
And it is it so deeply, darkly unsettling. It's brilliantly made, brilliantly acted, brilliantly written. It's a wonderful piece of cinema, and I can understand why so many people love it. But also, I agreed with the people that were saying, like, it does feel there's something inherently evil about it because of the narrative and because of the actions taken. I can be like, because that was quite, I would be like, right, who the hell wrote that, and what is wrong with them, and what what are they planning on doing in their own time?
Yeah.
Who are they both just like making a movie about some dragons and a farmer named Farmer with a little magical boomerang? Literally. Like, it's all right, mate.
That's what I mean. And I was going to mention it before because I think it's really interesting what you mentioned about the fact that he was getting that kind of hate from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got to kind of track back to who were those people.
Mm.
And it was the video game adaptation.
Yeah.
So it's
the nerds, as he kept calling them.
He kept calling them nerds, which I'm sorry, it was quite funny. As long as he wasn't using a slur, I was quite happy. But when he did, I kind of turned off a little bit. He basically, and we experience this a lot now in like the fandom era, right? We're used to the rabid fans.
Yeah.
But that's basically where it started.
Yeah.
And that caused a snowball effect. You also had the benefit of the internet being much more anonymized generally, as opposed to you can now, but it's harder and it's for more specific places.
Yeah, like most message boards, everyone had a username, no one went by their real name. You'd maybe know their first name, like Twitter, but you wouldn't put a picture up or anything.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like the perfect storm at the beginning there, and it's only snowballed further and further through reputation and things like that. And then you get to the point where, you know, he's provoked so much, because we said that, didn't we, when we were watching it, that it's so interesting to go from seeing the proposition of the boxing match to be something from like an egotistical person that can't handle criticism.
You don't like my movies, so I'm gonna beat you up.
Yeah, was not that,
like, not from, in the slightest. From,
and I know we're saying as well, this potentially can be a bit biased, but there's physical evidence
of the bad reviews
and the death threats, like.
And it's not like we've not seen it. I mean, when we talked about Glitter, we saw all of the reviews only talked about Mariah Carey's personal life. Not a single review discussed the film. So it's not...
We know it's possible. And he was sort of... that. And another thing that I think we might have touched on before, that we knew, that he actually does box.
Mm-hmm.
That was something that he did when he was younger. So with the contextual jigsaw pieces, it makes for a very different view of the scenario, which was a guy that wanted to make movies and pissed off people who kind of are a bit entitled, who went way over the line, made things personal, and he kind of dug into his arsenal of, I don't want to take this anymore, I know how to defend myself because I'm a boxer. If you really want to physically threaten me, bring it on.
It's also a very old school masculine thing. You can see it in like sitcoms, like sparring and stuff. Yeah. It's like, right, you guys just are being dicks. Fight it out. And then the winner is the winner. You get it out in
the
ring.
But that's the one thing you can say about that kind of masculine thing is, it's like deer, like it's like stags.
Yeah.
They accept the the result.
Yeah.
And you could see these journalists.
Well, a couple of them did. There was like the little 17-year-old journalist who was like,
oh, I'm not saying they have to take it well.
Yeah, but so, the little 17-year-old one took it well and was like, oh, I'm going to go for brunch with him tomorrow. And then there was another guy who, bless him, I don't know if he took it well or not, he was vomiting in the street.
But you could but they respect the result of who is.
But the other guy,
to say it, but like the alpha scenario.
But then there was one of the guys like, I didn't like him before. No, I hate him. And
I don't remember that bit. Yeah.
He lost. Like, they all lost. But like it was the dickhead journalist that we didn't like from the start. But he was just like, oh, well, I didn't like him before, but now I hate him. And it's like, sorry, mate, he beat you. Like,
and everyone can see, like, So, it was really interesting to see the group of people that ended up doing the boxing matches, because we were laughing, weren't we? Because it said, you know, after all that, only four people were actually chosen.
Yeah.
So it's hilarious to think these people were like, and one of the guys that was the worst, he didn't get, he wasn't on there. Yeah. Do you remember the guy with the flag in the background?
Yeah.
Who was like proper, yeah, he was just on one about like, kept pronouncing his name wrong as well, which I wasn't happy with. Because like, if you're gonna like make threats and,
yeah,
you know,
don't need to stoop to
make digs. No, yeah. But I just think he didn't even bother to learn how to say his name. So
oh, no,
it's just hilarious.
I got the impression that he was doing it on purpose.
Oh, I see, maybe. Like, but anyways, like, not everyone even got a chance to do it, which is kind of a bit of a flag on his, you know,
yeah.
On his, like, you're not even worth
fighting.
Or maybe he just felt actually unsafe with those people. True. I don't know. But it was really interesting, this group of people. One of the young guy was an amateur boxer. There was a couple of other journalists, but oh my God, they got beaten to a pulp.
Yeah.
Because the guy knows what he's doing.
But I think, like, the boxing stuff was very interesting, but I think when we were watching it, the thing that we said, like, because it's an 89-minute movie.
Yeah.
It was a good 50, 60 minutes before the boxing match ever even floated.
Yeah.
And I think we were both saying how fascinating it was, because, yeah, he's not the mad fighting man that everyone says. We were watching him try and get his film distributed and watching him talk to his parents.
It was like a natural progression of events.
Yeah.
Because you learn about who he is at the beginning, a little bit of his background with his family, what kind of boy he was.
Yeah.
Not super detailed, but you see him with his family. He talks about, and he's so knowledgeable about film.
Yeah.
Like he said that, and it was like, this is tapping into my feeling sad for lonely people kind of like thing of like, he said, you know, back in those days, you didn't have phones to text your mates. So if you didn't make plans, that was it. You spend the whole weekend on your own. I assume he's an only child. I don't
think. You got the impression.
So he spent his days in the movie theatre and
that's
he learned.
That's how I spend my days now, and I'm a 33-year-old.
It's because they were just showing him with these plinky plonky music and like tears in his eyes, where he was like,
"Wait, so
I had no friends."
When I go out on Sunday and I go and see like four films and The IFI and The Lighthouse, because I have no friends and no one to spend any time with,
if
so
you,
I just video it.
Yeah,
and then
send it to me. No, send it to
over.
Me with like Puss in Boots. I was like, but I'd be like, "This sounds like a great day." This is the thing. I'd be like, I actually would love to go and see four films. Oh my God. But no, I don't know, it was very, they did very well, and I know I'm easily manipulative, but they did very well at kind of like just getting us to see how he felt emotionally with all of this stuff going on, because he was talking at length about how he's just a guy who wanted to make movies. He was really interested in them growing up, you know, circumstantially. Again, that's saying he spent a lot of time watching them. And he had like a book where he was like reviewing them for like 12 years, and he said he'd seen thousands, hundreds of thousands or something. And then one day, 16,000, that's it. And then one day he said, I don't want to judge films anymore, I want to make them.
Yeah.
And it was a really interesting kind of, not ironic, but little like nod to what was going to happen. So when you kind of understand that kind of context, it just, the personal attacks as well, particularly, just feel completely like, I don't know, not only unwarranted, but just so much harsher and damaging to this guy who's just, like, doing his own thing. Like, we were saying, like, how awful would people feel if, like, this was in the news, like, someone decided to, you know, not pursue a typical career because they dreamed of being a baker and they opened up their bakery and it wasn't great. Maybe it didn't get 5 stars, it got 3 stars
or
whatever.
The cakes were dry.
The cakes were dry, people were arming and ahhing, but for some reason it pissed off a particular community who expected more. And then that community, like, sent death threats, like, broke the window, you know. That would be in the news as, like, how awful that this has happened. But for some reason, people feel like they can just make comments on people's art, like, they're entitled to, like... I know it's not the best analogy in the world, but it's just, like... I don't know, like, a comparison of, like, you wouldn't do it in real life.
Yeah.
So why do you think it's acceptable to write this stuff online? I just thought it was really fascinating to just learn the background of him and... until he started going offensive himself, I was on his side.
Well, yeah, like, before we get to that bit in the fence of this, I think the thing that, like, I found the most fascinating was just watching him work. So we didn't really see him on the film set, but we saw all the stuff, and, like, I've continuously said I think he's an absolutely amazing producer, and I don't know why he isn't a producer, but he sort of is. He's a producer, director, and writer. He's just doing all the jobs, which I guess in independent filmmaking, that happens a lot too. You know, someone has to do all the jobs because they don't have the money to pay other people to do them. But it's just really fascinating watching him do all the business meetings and all the work he put into trying to get In the Name of the King.
And the way
disputed.
He was talking about all the money in the car, and he was explaining like how he works
so
with how he works with studios. Unfortunately, it was Harvey Weinstein he called out, but he was basically saying about how certain producers, they'll tell me they like my stuff and they'll do something about it versus those you know, he's very knowledgeable of the industry. He's got good contacts for the sake of what he needs to do. You know, it sounded like he was respected in the industry. He's just not respected by the general public.
Well, yeah, because he had, you know, he didn't end up getting distribution, but he got offered distribution by Sony. Spoilers for the film. But they will only give him a small amount, and he's like, no, I want more. But he does it, from what we could see in the doc, it seemed very respectful, that he had a very respectful conversation.
Yeah.
He didn't get the news he wanted. He took that on board. He decided, no, I want to do it this way. You've offered me this other way. I don't like that other way. So maybe I'll find a completely third, different option, which is what he did. But even then, that turned out to be a bad thing, and he lost a lot of money.
Is that because he decided to release it
independently?
But
he seemed to have taken that on the chin.
Well, I think the point was that he took the risk.
Yeah.
Because with Sony, he was talking about how they could only guarantee a certain amount. And it kind of gave the impression that he said, well, that's all I'm going to get then.
Yeah, so they said, we'll give you theatrical release, but we can only guarantee 300. We'll start with 300. He was like, no, that's not a start. That just means it's going to be 300.
Yeah, because I think it's fair to assume that when you're with big studios, they will deliver what they've promised, and that's it. They're not going to go above and beyond unless it's going to make them money.
Yeah.
So I think it made sense to him that it's not in their best interest. If that's all that they can offer him beyond what he can do, is that going to limit it?
Yeah.
And I think that's the risk he took. He was like, I don't want to limit myself. Yeah. I think he might have even said that. I don't want to limit myself by going with them and kind of... But to other people, that would have been a safe bet, and they would have been happy with that. And then, unfortunately, I think it only got released, on 6 screens, something...
No, it got more than that. That was postal.
Oh, that was postal.
But it didn't get a very high...
It was only out for 2 weeks, I think, that
But I just thought it showed him, to my mind, and again, it's a documentary that he's had a lot of insight into. He's not listed in the crew anywhere, but obviously he's been given them access, so I'd imagine he was quite curated about what he let them access and what stuff he showed them. But it just seemed, he seemed like a very professional man who knew what he was talking about, knew his work. As you said, I think the main problem, and we've touched on it before in previous episodes, you can't manufacture talent. Mm. Oh, no, sorry, not talent.
I originally said create, but manufacture's right.
Yeah.
Because it's this idea of, if I work really hard, I'll do it.
But it just doesn't have the sparkle.
No.
But
it might work for some people.
Yeah.
I think the difference is that what people understand as talent is when it comes to art.
Yeah.
Because art is subjective, what we deem artistic geniuses as is that collectively the majority agree.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's plenty of people that I love, you love, like you've been trying to get me into Taylor Swift for years.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and sometimes
I would now like less people to be into Taylor Swift.
This is
horrifically difficult to get. I have them though, guys, I have them.
It's if you think conceptually about successful people and people who are critically doing, and it happens all the time. I'll watch something that I know has got people going, this is the best thing, and then it completely changes how you view it.
Yeah.
Because then you go, something that might be really boring to you, you go, but it's a classic.
Yeah.
Or, I know this is meant to be really bad, so it's actually more funny than it is good, when actually, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And it's really hard subjective opinion.
I didn't like Oppenheimer, but you loved Oppenheimer.
Yeah.
But me knowing how much other people like Oppenheimer it made me sit and think of it, and I was like, right, I didn't like it, but why did I not like it? And I'd say it was the emotion, it was the lack of emotion for me. I found it, personally, very cold, very staid. I just got information. I didn't feel like I got a story.
Yeah. Whereas I found it one of the most emotionally affecting things I've watched this
because
year.
Because our emotions because we all
experience things differently, yeah.
But then it also helped because I was like, okay, but cool. I was like, because I wanted the story to be about a different... I wanted a different telling of the story. Yes. But I was like, I'm not the filmmaker. Christopher Nolan is the filmmaker. Yeah. Cool. So what has he been doing in this film that makes him interested in telling the story? And there's a lot of really cool filmmaking bits in the film.
Yeah.
It just didn't click with me.
Yeah.
And I went on a tangent there and I have no idea what I was talking
about.
No,
because we were just talking about how some people will like Uwe Boll's stuff.
Yeah. So I was thinking about the Florence Pugh chair scene.
Oh, yeah, no, that didn't work for me either. Some people will like Uwe Boll's stuff. Because we were saying you can't manufacture talent.
Yeah.
But talent is different to other people. Yeah. And the general conception of talent is a universally or majority recognised exception of skill. And in this instance, it's artistic skill.
Yeah.
So the reason we're saying he doesn't have talent per se is because we know universally, it's almost as if it's a preconceived notion.
Yeah.
We can't really know as individuals. We've only got our subjective view of it. So we don't think it's talented per se, but if everyone else did, can we really say he's not talented?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's just, gone completely philosophical there, but it's just so interesting that there's like this thing of like...
Well, there seems to be a big difference between like, people seemed to, at least in this case, be like, he's not an exciting filmmaker, therefore he is a bad filmmaker. Whereas the films that we've watched,
What's that word you use? You said he's like very proficient.
Well, because we make that joke, or I make the joke all the time, this give me Channel 5 afternoon.
Yeah.
And
does its job and it gets out.
It's content at the end of the day, and I hate to be a content manufacturer, but content has existed for years, pretty much since the advent of art.
Yeah.
Content became a thing. We just didn't call it that back in the day.
Yeah.
But, you know, when TVs became in homes...
We made it
they
to
had
entertain
to...
ourselves because shit was boring.
And that was it. This was in the era of the DVD market. So shops wanted more DVDs to get out. They wanted different films because people were sitting at home getting a takeaway and watching DVDs together. So, but, like, it's like, just because he's not exciting and doesn't mean that they're bad. And I said, like, I think he'd be great working on a TV soap.
He
can get in, he gets the job done, works professionally, knows how to talk to people, knows how to talk to actors, and then gets the job done in the budget and off he goes. He'd be great on a long-running TV show.
Yeah.
I just think film is not the right outlet for
the
medium.
Either he needs a different role in that, or it needs to be a different medium, Because it's a very different thing, writing an article for a newspaper versus writing a book.
Yeah.
But the action of reading it is still the same. But you're looking at it for different reasons. The way it's written is different, etc. Yeah. So I co-created the statement of the manufacturing talent. But again, it is just this sense of perception of what that actually is. But yes, he was very impressive with his producer stuff. I wrote down that the way he can convince people to give him money, like, if everyone's claiming he's such a bad filmmaker, like, is he that good a businessman? Or is he actually just not that? Is he both? Is he not that bad a filmmaker and he's a very good businessman? Yeah. And it's just this weird snowball thing that's happened purely because of him, his style combined with the material he was working with at the time. And at the time as well, like...
The era,
like, 2000s, everyone was just super angry, especially in America, like, for obvious reasons. And I think the advent of the...
Oh, my God, I was just like, what? 2000s in America, and then I was like...
I'm looking at the camera. I've read a lot about... I can't remember what... I think it kind of went around on Twitter for a little while about, like, there was a video of, like, showing high schoolers, like, just before it happened or something.
Oh,
and someone and someone said, you know, high school just wasn't the same after that.
Yeah.
And then you get all the school shootings. And then you get all of that, you know. Yeah. And you can recognise it now, you know, in, like, the kind of, like, style of the 2000s. You get all the emo musical, like, scars and, like, all the grungy, like, the sores and all of this. Yeah, it just kind of reflected in its art. But it also reflected in the culture of being online and the hate and the chasing down celebrities and, you know, all of that stuff. So I definitely think it was just this perfect storm of all of this stuff going on. And we were also saying it's really interesting to watch something like this of how films are getting made and produced and the distributors sort of exhibits and things like that, considering we've got the strikes at the moment. Mm-hmm. You know, thinking about how things have changed with streamers now versus, because that was the DVD market. Claire was explaining to me a little bit about like when you'd get a film and when people would buy it and when people would view it. And it's just like how much that has that changed now and how, you know, with the DVD, I said also people would go around picking films. Some of them would then keep them because they didn't want that release because it was similar to something else they've got, or they'd hold it off until someone became famous.
Like everyone has watched a film on a streaming service because Melissa McCarthy's face is in it. Then to sadly realise Melissa McCarthy is in about 5 minutes, two scenes. And it's just not a very good comedy. Shout out to the Better Than Bad podcast where I watched Food Fight starring Melissa McCarthy.
Right. Not the food fight we've got to do on our one.
I'm sure it was called Food Fight. She is front and central of the poster. She is in two scenes, both of which were cut out of the original release.
Stop.
They re-released it when she became famous and put them back in and made them, like, extended them.
Wow.
And put her on the front of the poster.
You were saying that they did that when she got nominated for an Oscar, right? So it's just the after Bridesmaids effect. It's so interesting how it all works. We don't get to see that. But now we're seeing the strikes and things that are happening. Mm. We know with all of that, the cancellations and people revealing about the residuals they didn't get from working in the... Did you hear about the Disney shows and how they would rebrand so they didn't have to pay their actors?
That's been going on for years.
Yeah, exactly. The Suite Life on Deck thing.
Everyone's really excited about Daredevil, but it won't be Daredevil season 4. It'll be Daredevil Reborn. So they start everyone back on the original salary.
Yeah.
Just like, absolutely. They're still doing it. Yeah.
So
Hannah Montana forever.
Yeah. It's almost as if all of our eyes have been opened now because we didn't realise this was happening, but this has been happening to people for so long. But what do you do? It's the industry.
Yeah.
What do they do?
Like if Miley Cyrus was one of the most underpaid Disney Channel stars in the fucking late 2000s, like I worked in Disney World in the Disney store, that bitch's face was on everything.
Yeah, exactly.
Like she is a mega millionaire now, I assume, but she should have been one years before.
And that's not just the point. These are regular people with regular jobs as well. Mm-hmm. But those studios are making the money off of those people's faces.
Yeah.
They would not be making anything without those people, and that's the point. Like, you know, some people are kind of combining it with like, oh, but these actors are entitled and all of this. But it's just like you wouldn't have anything with everyone, but you wouldn't have exactly that without exactly that cast.
Yeah.
Because people go to see cast specifically, and then directors maybe second.
The
general public would be people who are in it.
This has nothing to do with the available film now. We've gone on a whole strike tangent, but I love it. The argument that always annoys me is when people are like, I don't get paid for work I did in 2012. Like, yeah, hon, no one's looking at your PowerPoint presentation that you made in 2012.
No one's making money off of the work you did. Yeah. That's the difference.
No one is making money off the emails that you sent in 2012, hon. Whereas
if you were to come up with a invention...
Yeah, the person who made the cronut, I'm sure if they TM'd that or whatever you called it, like they will still get money anytime anyone uses.
So take the cronut, for example.
Do we just need to come buy some cakes?
No, because
we're just doing a lot of bakery talk.
The gluten's building up, I can't. if they'd have just made that and then a company come along gone, or Starbucks, come along, I like the look of that, we're gonna start selling those. It would not be, and that was you that made it. You'd be like, they stole my idea. That's what patents and trademarks are for. People can't trademark their face.
Yeah.
But, you know, all this stuff with the AI. You can buy
the dead person's face, though, and make them in an advert for Galaxy.
Anyway, So we've gone on a bit of a tangent now. Interesting about comparing the different ways that the market is.
Yes. So would you like to talk about the tangent that Mr. Bowl goes on towards the end of the film that made you suddenly fall out of love with your new favourite person?
The tangent, what, when you started just naming directors?
So after the boxing fight, he then went on to make Postal, and the documentary sort of implies that he's like, well, no one's liked my adaptations and my big budget films, so I'm going to go and I'm going to make a really low budget personal film and be the person that everyone thinks I am.
Because that was what it was. It was that after the boxing matches he won, and then he said on the mic, he was just like, as you can see, the journalists that the journalists that came here today were ill prepared for the boxing matches, just as they, obviously not this eloquently, might I add, and with a bit more swearing probably, but basically said they're just as ill prepared when they're boxing as they are writing their reviews. And you know, after all of that, I kind of was just like, yeah, fair enough. Like, he was spitting facts up until that point in terms of, and it isn't just the fact that he was like the victim in the situation up to that point, and I felt for him. He took it on the chin for the most part. And so you had to respect him for like dealing with this shit. He was like, I'm just out here to make movies, and you're just like getting all up in my grill. But then after that, things started to spiral. And I think it was around about the petitions. So the petitions, I think, started with Blood Rain.
Yeah, but then when he
did it in the name of the king.
Yeah, but then when he was doing Postal, it like, knew what. Yeah. He was like, if you can get it to a million, I won't release my film.
Yeah, and I think that's because it was after the, probably after the boxing match where he got a lot of press.
Yeah.
And then he started getting a lot more attention, because I can't imagine, I don't know, maybe if anyone knew of him at the time and when it was happening, let us know. What did you, like, how much press did it get? Like, how well known was he, like, I'm sure, I don't think he was a household name, but maybe in America, like, I don't
think he was a household name for film fans. Right. I think he was a household film for, like, online people, like, people on message boards and stuff. Like, if you
like,
were
maybe,
very,
like, maybe we would know, like, who Ari Aster is, but, like,
if people were, yeah.
My mum wouldn't know who Ari Aster is.
So. Yeah, I think for people that were very online at that time, he was a big household name.
So, it kind of feels like he won, but at what cost? Because he drew more attention to himself.
And then realised that no, like,
and
all
people just doubled down.
Press.
Yeah.
So then he starts going for the bad attacks. He starts doing everything that he said that other people should be doing about him.
Yeah, because I think he did everything that he could up until that point, but you can't stop it. And it drew more attention. And then he kind of just got himself in this position where, like he said, in the, there was a clip of him where he was calling out, like, he was like, we don't care what, like, Michael Bay and Eli Roth, like, repeat, but he, like, called Michael Bay a slur and, like, said all of this stuff. And, like, he was like, I got emotional and I have to live with that now. Yeah. So he, like acknowledges it, but that's done. You can't take that back. And then he'd go on, like, talk shows where they'd be like, it kind of felt a little bit, and I know he's, like, a man and it's not something, he's, like, a 50-year-old man or something, he doesn't need to be protected, but at the same time it's like the press, like, they take advantage of people, so they know they rile them up, they know what's going to make a good story, and you know, maybe he thought he could come off as the good guy in it, maybe not, maybe, I don't know, but he ended up pissing off way more people, and now he's at the point where he's releasing films, and like they showed the like premiere for Postal, and like there really was not that many people there.
And then, but then he went on a really weird, titled rant about.
Oh, he kept saying stuff about how
he was a genius.
Like that. So I think it just tipped him over the edge.
But it was interesting because like Postal was what, 2009-ish. He did make a comment that we now hear all the time now, that he said, film viewers are just sheep. They just, like, go into the movies that are big and saying that all these, like, mediocre, plain, same movies are great so that they'll get invited to a premiere for Pearl Harbor 2 and they're just in the pocket.
And that's, like, say, it's exactly and what people are saying
people
now with
say
influencers.
That all the time with influencers. So it's really,
and there was a Guardian article about it recently.
Yeah, there was.
Yeah.
So, which I was not entirely, I didn't really support a lot of what the Guardian article was saying.
No, not necessarily, but it was drawing light to the difficulty of
criticism
and what is
influencing.
What is PR.
Yeah, yeah. But so it was interesting that like he was seemed to be quite ahead of his time with that one, whether you agree with it or not, he seemed to coin that argument.
Yeah, yeah, no, exactly. We were watching this and we definitely felt like it was reminiscent or just felt interesting to watch, knowing what sort of
like 13, going on now. 13 years after the documentary was released.
Yeah. Which, so, and it would have been happening years before that as well. But it was interesting, like, one of the sort of the last things I noted down was one of the comments he made was, is it worth making movies? This was right at the beginning, actually. With all the arseholes that are in the business, he said, and then you get negative reviews. So, like, you have to kind of respect that he carried up. It would have turned a lot of people off to kind of deal with that. And I'm not saying people should have to put up with it either, and that the people that turned away are cowards or anything. But he should, like, fair play. Like, he pushed on and he carried on. He was like, I just want to make films. Like, people are paying me to do it. and it's getting releases, or I'm releasing it myself. Yeah. I'm just trying to do my thing. He was like, I like making movies and I want to make money from them.
Yeah.
As anyone who is doing any kind of thing and bringing it into the world and adding value to it, that's how we create money in this society. So he should be allowed to want to make money from what he's making, as well as being passionate about what he's doing. And that, interestingly, is a conversation that's coming up a lot as well, about sort of actors sort of now feeling ready. There's a few actors that have come out and gone, I want to be able to say, or I have said, this is a job for me.
Yeah.
Like, I don't have to be the world's biggest Snow White fan to play Snow. And I think it was Penn Badgley that said, I just want to say that this is a job. I don't want to say that this was a passion project for me since I was five. And
I've always spent my life wanting to be a serial murderer stalking women. It gives me such joy.
Yeah.
It's like, no, like, I thought the story was interesting, and I also enjoy having
a job.
Because
that pays money.
Food costs money.
They just, people don't, and I think it's, you know, people don't really, people think that all actors are millionaires, but it's not. There's still like a tiered system.
I highly recommend finding the Orange is the New Black article on that one. There was a really good,
because they were,
say it was Variety that kind of pulled everything together. I'll see if I can find
it. Because that made Netflix.
Made Netflix.
And then these actresses weren't getting any money.
They were all working in bars. They were all working because they could not afford to give up their day jobs whilst working on one of the biggest shows of the last 10 years.
It's just, you know.
And even the creators said, like, when they went into Netflix at the end of the show, when the show ended, to go in and talk about, like, future projects that they might want to work on together, Netflix finally showed them, like, the viewing figures and, like, some of the money accrued from the show. And they're like, oh my God, what do you think about that? And they'd be like, oh my God, I can't believe we've been this successful. Yeah. And they were like, where's, I think we money? Should have asked to renegotiate our contract a good few years ago.
Yeah.
Like, they were horrified. They were like, we should, why on earth did we not go in and ask for more?
But that's not their fault.
Not their, they were, and like, because that's the big thing about Orange is the New Black, is saying, like, it's not just that a streaming service was maybe taking people for a bit of a ride, but unfortunately it was
like
also,
built the model for it.
It was also female and
LGBT.
LGBT and, like, diverse.
Like,
you know,
racially diverse.
Racially diverse. Underrepresented people.
Groups,
underrepresented groups. So they don't have that negotiating power because they're fucking terrified that this is the one. Oh my God, it's an all-female cast that has diverse bodies, diverse shapes, diverse voices. I don't want to say I don't want to do this because when does this come along again? But they are also, but
they back people into a corner, don't they? Yeah.
And then they take a ride on them because they're like, well, you know, you're just lucky that this is being made. You're really lucky as a Latina actress that you get to be on a poster. Like,
yeah. And this is what the strike's all about at the moment, isn't it? And I'll be honest, I had a conversation recently where I was just like, are we actually allowed to do our podcast? Because we're like talking about films and stuff. And they were like, as long as you don't want to be an actor in the Screen Guild, that's fine. Because the directors have already had their stuff signed off. I'm like, okay, well, at least maybe I did. If I did want to be a director, it might be all right.
But no, even if you wanted to be an actor, we're absolutely allowed to do a podcast.
What, because it's...
Because it's not acting.
No, but you can't be promoting stuff.
Yeah, but we're not promoting... You're not promoting your acting work.
Yeah, but... Why, so then why do, oh, so it's like the podcast, like Wizards of Waverly Place, because it's their own stuff.
Yes.
Ah, and the Office Ladies.
Yes. So they, like, Jenna Fisher can go onto a health and wellness podcast and talk about her book.
Yes.
But so she cannot
talk about The Office.
Yeah.
So why are critics worried about promoting films?
Because
they haven't understood what this is about.
95% of critics aren't worried. 5% of idiots are worried.
Oh, there we go. Well, you heard it here first. There you go.
I'm sorry, it's true. Yeah. If you think criticism, if you think being a film
critic,
but
what about influencers then?
That is mildly
different.
But
it's not their work.
So this is the thing. So the critic thing is, if you think that a film criticism, a film review, is promotion, absolutely not. It is a review. It is journalism.
Yeah.
Yes, companies can then use it as promotion.
Well, that was my job, right? So that, like, we
would
take outreach.
The great review.
So what we did as in a PR company, if we're promoting a film or a DVD or a TV show, we would have our contacts in the industry, and our job is to get them aware of it and to get them a screener and to encourage them to write reviews, but also features, interviews, things like that. The review itself, and it should be honest, yes, it's promotional, but it's a critique. Yeah. Whereas the interviews, etc., yeah, are purely to get people to go and yeah, watch it.
Yeah.
So that's, I guess, where the difference is.
The grey area of influencers is that technically, as an influencer, you are making, well, and the majority of high-profile influencers are making paid content. So yes, if you are being an influencer for the Barbie movie, you are getting sent stuff.
You are part
Barbie
of that
Mattel
marketing team.
You are becoming someone who is paid by marketing to promote a Barbie right promotion.
Whereas critics don't get paid by the studios to promote the movie. Yeah. They are independent.
They're independent. And the problem being them, a lot of influencers, you know, like, is it Addison Rae or...
Oh, yeah, the TikTok.
Yeah, she was a TikTok influencer who then went to work for Netflix. So she was in a Netflix movie as an actress, and I think she wants to be an actress now. So, well, if you want to get into the Screen Actors Guild, but you were doing paid-for promotion, even though it's an influencer video, that is technically acting, and you're technically doing an advertising campaign for the movie.
Wow.
Because you're doing paid-for promotion. It's not technically, but technically it could be. It's a real great area.
You don't want to be doing it, because if it can backfire on you in a legal way...
Yeah, and so like, there's nothing wrong with it. There is absolutely nothing wrong with influencers still doing advertising for movies right now. There was absolutely nothing wrong with an influencer
but if
doing paid for promotion.
But
if they want, if they are only being an influencer because they want to eventually become an actor, they're fucking themselves over.
Right.
You're to be an influencer because you like influencing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Go get your money, hon. I wish I could.
Mm.
But like, it is only a concern if you think in the future you would like to go and make movies.
Right. Well, there you go. A little sidebar there, just to clear that up for me.
Was I ranty?
No. I just know. It's good to understand that. Even, like, because I even know, from my perspective as a PR, what the difference is, but then you start going into, but legally here, and what this means for different groups, what this means for the union, blah, 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 and it's just like, you know, the directors' guilds have signed an agreement, and then you've got independent studios signing agreements. So it's like, well, they can do it, the directors can do it, you know, so it's ever-changing still. You know?
Yeah, I do
it
like...
It probably would have changed by the time this is released.
I love the fact that A24 are getting ahead, because I, you know, A24 hits the shill. But I think it's just a really great thing for... to be in the press coming from the guilds, should be like, hey, yeah, we're all striking, but we're going to let this A24 film be made. Do you know why? Because A24 as a studio have already agreed to every single one of our requirements. Yeah. And actually, this
They're
film production
example of
already
what
meets everything we want.
Yeah.
A24 are fucking tiny compared to Warner Brothers. And A24 were already doing it. So what the fuck are the rest of you playing about?
Yeah.
So part of that is... not to say marketing, but it is clever.
Well, it's just
optics from the strikers, but it's also fucking good because it shows how simple
but you
it
wouldn't,
is.
But you wouldn't strike from somewhere that you've made a deal with.
Yeah.
That's the point. They're striking because they can't come to a negotiation.
Yeah, yeah. And that company is already, everything they're trying to negotiate, that company already does.
Yep.
So.
Yeah. But we'll see what happens. But yeah, back to Uwe Boll. So we've seen this documentary. I like really, really recommend watching this documentary, even if you don't watch any of his films.
We watched it on Tubi in America. We were temporarily in
Atlanta. We're in America!
thank you. So yeah, Tubi in America. It's not currently streaming for free anywhere in the UK, but you probably can rent it online.
Mm-hmm. And so we've got one more Uwe Boll film, I think.
I think we've just got
House of Dead, which is his most prolific one.
And the highest on the list.
The highest on the list. So,
we've not got any plans to do it yet. But
no,
that doesn't mean I doubt we'll do it this year. But that doesn't mean we won't do it soon.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because the reason we've done so many of our Boll films is because the way that we kind of prioritise, or I've decided to prioritise the list, is to focus on ones that are just free.
Available to watch.
It's good for us, it's good for the guests, it's good for listeners if people want to watch it long. That one isn't, but the rest of them are. So it was interesting. I wonder what's going on behind the scenes over on Uwe Boll's estate, and he's deciding, yes, they should. I will pay for streaming rights for all of these films now. I suppose, you know, he just wants to make a little bit of an extra buck.
I'm going to do a little checkaroo if it's streaming in any other country that I have access to.
Oh, right. How many other countries do you have access to?
All the countries.
All of them.
But I changed my letterbox to do all the free streaming services in America.
Right. So yes, I think most of them are freebie, weren't they? Oh no.
VPNs are kind of illegal, aren't they?
I don't know. They're pretty easy to get for being illegal.
I just don't know the use of them. Because like we have one at work. We have to legally have one at work for our work stuff.
But then what legal use would you get for a VPN?
like work. So like we log on to the VPN so that it knows if thinks that we're in the office, so that we can have access to private documents that you can't use outside the office.
But that's, yeah, exactly. So that's technically against your security.
Yeah, true.
Things. So I just don't see how there's a legal use, but I don't know.
Well, House of the Dead doesn't seem to be streaming anywhere that I know of.
Right. Maybe it'll come around, but we'll of course eventually get to the ones, even if we rent them anyway. But yeah, we might as well prioritize. We've got plenty to watch that's available for free, so why spend our hard-earned cash on stuff?
I do miss going into CEX Dartford, though, and confusing the shit out of them.
Oh, yeah. Here's my watch list for the week, and it's the most garbage pile of... But listen, I'm the one that ends up liking them all, so there we are.
We're going to get done in under an hour, Daisy. Look at us.
This is amazing. We would love to know if you're going to watch this film. And I don't know, like, I feel like I want to know what people's opinions of Uwe Boll are like. Mm. What do you think? Have you seen any of his stuff, like... Have you got any stories? We had our previous guest, Warren, told us a story about he went to the premiere of Postal. But yeah, so find us on Twitter and Instagram at WRatedPod and on Letterboxd at WRated. Claire, where can we find you?
You can find me at Claire Ellen Hope on Twitter and Instagram. Maybe posting about being at Venice Film Festival. I'm a judge in the upcoming British Independent Podcast Awards. So I might be talking about that. Yeah.
And then you can find me at Twitter at Daisy Vic Edwards and then Instagram and Letterboxd Daisy Victoria Edwards. So yeah. Cool. Thanks for tuning in, everyone. As always, if you enjoy listening to our podcast. We just plodded along. If you enjoy listening to our pod, please do give us a follow or subscribe. And if you're feeling generous, a rating or review. We hope you join us for the next episode, where we will actually be taking on our next worst rated film.
I bet we won't be. I bet something will
it's
just
It's going to be another special.
No, it won't be.
It's not February just yet.
It will probably, if I don't fuck myself up, it'll probably be The Wicker Man starring Nicolas Cage.
Stay tuned.
See ya.